I'm Peter Simonson, interviewing Carolyn R. Miller on May 31st, 2018. So, Carolyn, when did you first join RSA?
Well, you know, I don't really remember. It must have been in the late 80s, because I think I was elected to the board in 92. So I must have been a member before then, but that's as close as I can date it. I don't recall, you know, my initial involvement with RSA for some reason. That just does not stand out.
Do you remember when you first heard about the organization?
No, I don't. It was probably from Michael Halloran, my dissertation director. You know, I had finished in 84. But as my mentor, I think I was still sort of relying on him to negotiate the landscape, the organizational / intellectual landscape, because I felt myself connected both to the English department world and the communication department world. I was a member both of NCA, or SCA as it was then probably, and the Four Cs. I remember RSA, you know, must have been very small and not particularly influential at the time, but I don't know, I may have gotten involved through one of the early, okay, well, I don't know. All right, I'm totally free associating here. Michael Halloran was conference director for the 92 conference in Minneapolis, which was the first one outside Arlington. I never went to any of the Arlington ones, but I did go to that one. So that might have been my first introduction, in which case I got elected to the board right away somehow. And I don't know how that would have happened.
Welcome to the association.
Right. We're desperate.
How would you describe the organization when you first joined it?
Well, small and I guess I'd say inconspicuous, you know, in the general landscape of both publication and conference sponsorship. I'm also now trying to remember the date of my first publication in RSQ, which was probably around 88. So I must have heard about it by then. Again, I don't have that date right at the tip of my fingertips. I should have looked that kind of thing up. And I don't know why I submitted there exactly. It was a piece on the special Aristotle's special topoi, and it was clearly not appropriate for 3Cs, and I didn't think I could get it into QJS, so that seemed to be the place to go, I guess. You know, again, I can't recuperate any of that. I might have some stuff in my files about that submission, but not in my brain. Sorry.
Not at all. So that first conference, when you say inconspicuous, do you mean inconspicuous sort of nationally and institutionally?
Yeah. It was just not a particularly important venue for, I think, for anyone. Those of us interested centrally in rhetoric, I think, we're still sort of trying to find a way. And there were people like Mike Leff, for example, who would show up at 4Cs, not every time, but occasionally. And a few of us would show up from 4Cs would show up at NCA. So we were all kind of trying to find out, where's the rhetoric going on? because I had no colleagues in my own department in rhetorical studies. There were a few in the comm department at NC State. I should say that I was in the English department. And again, I think it was, we were all just kind of exploring and trying to find each other and find out where's the conversation going to happen.
And can you remember that first conference you went to, what that was like, what that you said it was small?
Yeah.
Do you have any memories that stand out?
No, I really don't. I'd have to go back to my CV to even remember what paper I gave there. It might have been the one that I ultimately published in RSQ. I'd have to check. I didn't do my homework for this interview, obviously. I'm sorry.
No.
I didn't know what... Had I known the questions, I might have reread my CV.
Do you remember what RSA was doing when you first joined, what its projects or goals were, or the sense of the organization?
I think it was just trying to stay alive, you know, in an important sense. I remember there was a kind of a big debate about moving the conference away from Arlington, because Chuck Kniper had sponsored these first four, I mean, just sort of on their own. And I don't know how the RSA connection was made. I think it was just sort of done in the name of RSA, but there wasn't an apparatus in the organization to really set up a conference. So I think Kniper just said, I'm going to do this and call it RSA. And so after he died, you know, then what happens? And I think at that point, the organization decided, yeah, let's keep this up and let's not make it an Arlington thing, right? Whoever interviews Michael Halloran this afternoon, you know, he will certainly remember all of that better than I, because he chaired that conference as incoming president. But again, I think it was just a matter of it was all very casual, very low budget, very just sort of making it up as we go along.
And so that was the 90s that you first became
late
active.
Late 80s, early 90s, yeah.
Was there any sense at that time that cultural studies was on the horizon, or?
I don't think so. I think the only person who had that kind of an inkling was a guy named Walter Beal at UNC Greensboro, who wrote an article saying something, I think the title was something like, Rhetorical Studies is Cultural Studies. But I don't think anyone else was really paying attention to cultural studies at that time.
What are your most important or prominent memories related to RSA?
Okay. Well, somehow it became less inconspicuous, certainly in my intellectual life. It became, over time, my, you know, sort of the primary organization with which I identify and to which I have some kind of loyalty. And that was a very gradual process. Part of it had to do with my service on the board and as president. I chaired the 96 conference in Tucson. So I would have been president, I guess, from 96 to 98. And then I was past, you know, so once you get on the board, you know, you have like a decade's worth of service ahead of you. And that got me involved and invested. And I think if I can make any claim to having made a difference in the organization, it wasn't that we really had an agenda when I was president. I saw my job as simply keeping the thing going. We didn't take any major initiatives that I recall, except that I was interested in bringing more NCA members in. I knew a lot of rhetorical studies was going on in communication departments because of my sort of boundary straddling positionality. And I just thought, you know, where are the NCA people? Because most of the people on the board, when I served on the board, were from English departments. I think there were a couple who weren't. Michael F. probably being the major exception. And my one claim to fame is I got Jerry Hauser interested. I think I was on the nominating committee that nominated him for the board. And once he got involved, you know, whoosh, he knew how to take an organization and run with it. And he got very invested in it. The theme for the Tucson conference was the 25th anniversary of the publication of the Prospect of Rhetoric, the NCA developmental rhetoric program. And the keynote speakers were Ed Black and Lloyd Bitzer. And Rich Enos had suggested this as a possible theme to me because he had noticed that it was the 25th anniversary of the 1971 publication. And I thought, this is perfect because this is a theme that will draw in NCA rhetoricians, and the keynote speakers, again, being from the NCA side of things, should attract more submissions. And I've never done the data to see how the membership changed over time, how many NCA rhetoric people we actually drew to Tucson, but I know there were more than there had been in the past. So I think that was at least part of the beginning of a turning point in the organization where we became more ecumenical and more bi-departmental, if you will. Although it's always been part of the Constitution and always been part of I went back and read the first Constitution, which makes specific allowances that, if I can remember this correctly, the top two vote getters from English will be elected, the top two vote getters from communication will be elected, and then top voters from sort of every other discipline that might be represented, and then there was some other way of filling it out. But there was a very deliberate strategy in the first Constitution to embed kind of ecumenicalism within the structure. It didn't seem to take very well, and I think that early Constitution was ignored as much as it was followed, in part because as a young bootstrap organization, I think there were some sort of years when nothing happened, you know, in the early 70s and mid 70s. I don't think RSA really did much of anything. So there was a lot of floundering in the early years.
So was Michael Halloran NCA affiliated like you?
Yes. His department, the department I got my degree from, was a Department of Language, Literature, and Communication. The degree was a degree in communication and rhetoric. So it was not a traditional English department, and it had humanists of a variety of stripes, American studies, linguistics, technical communication, rhetorical studies. Michael really was the only one at the time. And so he was not, and his degree was from the same department. So he was not, I probably shouldn't say it this way, but I was going to say he was not polluted by being a member of an English department, and therefore I did not inherit, you know, I was employed by an English department and went back to being employed by an English department. But I was sort of inoculated, I think, with comm studies during my PhD work.
So
and started attending NCA and the Eastern Communication Association, some of the regionals as well.
So as far as you know, were Michael and you the first NCA affiliated presidents of RSA?
I think so, yes. I think so, yeah. Now, the first president who was a communication studies department member was Jerry Hauser. And and I can't remember the date on that. That was in the early 2000s, I guess. But Michael and, oh, and Fred Ansack was in a department of rhetoric. He preceded Jerry. And then Michael, not from an English department. I think all the other presidents were from English.
So you mentioned coming into RSA being a primary or your primary intellectual home as a prominent memory. Are there other memories that stood out maybe after that point?
Well, I guess, you know, the conference continued to grow in size and importance. And you know, and then the institutes were instituted, and I've attended not all of them, but most of them, and so maintained a kind of annual commitment to attending, and I'm going to just kind of complicate the story a little bit here. one of the other important venues for many of us in English rhetorical studies had been the Penn State Conference on Rhetoric and Composition, the summer conference, which, and again, I don't have the dates on that, but they ran that annually for quite a few years. And then they, I guess they just sort of wore their faculty out trying to, I think they went to a biannual or a themed thing. And so RSA kind of picked up when Penn State dropped off as a summer conference where rhetoricians gathered in a smaller, less formal venue than you get at the big major disciplinary conferences. So I think that was another way in which RSA became important to quite a number of us, was with the falling off of the Penn State conference. Other specific memories. Well, service as the editor of RSQ, that was a huge job. boy, I'm not sure what to say about that. I think, you know, I agreed to do it in part because of my commitment to the organization. In part because Greg Clark, whom I succeeded, twisted my arm, talked me into it, said, "It's not that hard." but again, it gave me a real inside view of, you know, what are people thinking about? What are they working on? What are they, you know, where's the field think it's going? And how do we, as a discipline, manage our intellectual work and help each other with our intellectual work and mentor the young? And I think this is an experience that every editor has, is just to be amazed at the generosity of reviewers in working with submissions and cultivating them, curating them, if you will, just sort of, you know, watching the dynamics of the interaction there. There again, when I chose reviewers, I tried very hard to always choose one reviewer from English and one from comm studies to try to ensure that the approach and the sort of the way that a problem or issue is pitched and the way it develops can speak to rhetoricians with both kinds of training and both kinds of interests, to try to integrate and knit together those somewhat disparate communities.
And how have you seen that particular nexus between the communication side and the English side evolve within the organization?
Well, I mean, I think it's been terrifically important. And you know, the ARS powwow that happened at Northwestern in, dates is going to escape me here, that Mike Leff and Andrea Lunsford put together. I think that was another very important venue when, at a time when RSA was trying to figure out its position in the map of rhetoric organizations. I think it kind of wanted to be the premier rhetoric organization, but couldn't just say so. but I think it, out of that confabulation, if you will, grew the realization on the part of everybody that this was the natural role for RSA. And I know that, who was it said this? It might have been Jerry Hauser, it might have been Mike Leff, that some of their colleagues hadn't believed it would work, hadn't believed that they really would find anything of interest in talking to English rhetoricians, but discovered in that meeting that they did, and that the conversation was worth having. And I think it was at that point that some of the comm studies rhetoricians realized that there was something outside of NCA that would be worth their while. And so the involvement of NCA rhetoricians began to grow, and I think that has made rhetorical studies as we know it now much richer and much more diverse, and just has made the conversations much more interesting and productive to have these fields speaking to each other on a regular basis, and have the journal deliberately try to address both communities.
Do you have a sense of the doxa in English departments at the time of the ARS with regard to comm?
A lot of the conversations that I heard, and occasionally continue to hear, is that there are still real turf issues within individual institutions. Those people won't collaborate, they think they own this, we think we, we can't get the conversation started. They're just not cooperative. And yet, when you get outside the, what it so often seems like the zero-sum game that happens in any individual university, when you get outside of that, in a venue like RSA, then I think the conversations can happen and people are willing to talk. One can only hope that it will trickle back down into the universities as institutions. And I know that the work that Roxanne Mountford and Bill Keith are doing is very much in this vein. I think each battle in each institution has to be different as to whether that kind of cooperation can happen, and if so, how, because institutional power structures and personalities vary so much. And whatever happens, this is one of the things I've learned in my old age, nothing is permanent. You get a new dean, you get a new provost, you get a different kind of university budgeting process, and the whole thing could blow up, whatever you've constructed.
With that in mind, and looking toward the future, how do you think RSA is going to continue to develop in years to come?
Well, I hope it can continue to serve as this sort of outside reference point, again, trans-departmental forum, where institutional politics can be superseded, and perhaps some of the real work that we have to do, both intellectually and politically is to figure out how to make the achievements that we have in RSA transportable into institutional contexts. And that, you know, that's a real tough assignment because it means changing institutional structures one by one. And those structures, especially English departments, are just so old and hoary that they're really hard to dislodge. And when you do dislodge them, as has happened in some cases, like University of Kentucky has this, University of Iowa has a department, you know, the sort of the between department program or department. University of Texas has one. Those can be, especially in their early years, very vulnerable, very unstable.
What are your hopes for the organization's future?
You know, keep on keeping on. I don't know whether I would hope for it to supersede NCA or the four C's. I think that's kind of unrealistic and maybe not even desirable. I'm not much of a visionary. I mean, I think what we're doing now is extremely valuable and very productive, and I don't know if we could do better. So higher education is changing, though, nationally and even internationally. And, you know, and so, you know, where it goes in the next decade, what things will look like, you know, in terms of state funding and public support is kind of scary. And whether RSA can sort of get out ahead of that process and secure a foothold in whatever the new dispensation looks like, that may be the biggest challenge. But I sure don't know how to do that. That's why I'm retired.
I'm going to double back and ask one question that wasn't on the list. Uh-huh. But as I look at the early founders of RSA, I see a lot of guys.
Yeah. Yeah,
and I should have double checked this, but were you the first woman president of the organization?
No, I was not. I think I was the second. Kathleen Welch preceded me, and Jan Swearingen succeeded me. So there are three women in a row, interestingly enough. And that probably is a generational thing. The early presidents, well, Ed Corbett was president for, I don't know, a decade, I guess. I think that was when the organization sort of went into abeyance. It really wasn't operating according to its constitution for a while. I guess it was probably goes back to the Arlington conferences, which I think in retrospect might be seen as sort of resuscitating the organization. Just now as we talk about it, I'm thinking this way, which then inspired the continuation after Kneiper's death. And then that got more people to join, particularly from English departments. And that was my generation. And rhetoricians in English departments, by and large, were women. And so that sort of brought the generation of women into it after this founding generation, which the Richard Youngs, the Ross Winterouds, the Henry Johnstones, I don't know who all else that was in that founding generation. But there weren't women in either department at that point, you know, full professors. So I think that is to a large extent, both generational and departmental, because of the heavy involvement of English department, at least in that sort of middle period.
And can you reflect a little on what that was like for you at that point in your career and entering an organization that was shifting a little bit? But
well, I didn't know that it was shifting because I had really was not much aware of its past. It didn't have a sense of itself as having a tradition. That sort of hadn't really, because it had sort of gone into abeyance for a while. It started for me with that 92 conference, I think, sort of de novo. It wasn't until later that I became aware that there was this previous generation that really got it started. So I was quite nonplussed to be elected to the board. I hadn't even been aware I was a candidate. I would just sort of, Rich Enos called me up and said, "Congratulations, you've been elected." What? So it kind of came out of nowhere, my involvement in the organization in that way. And then when I was elected president, I just sort of did my best to follow in the footsteps of my predecessor and plan this. The big work was planning the conference, and that's where I saw that maybe I could do something that would make a bit of a statement.
And that was the 25 year.
Yeah, or? Yeah, that was the choice of the theme in the keynote presenters. I'm not sure I can say much else about that. Again, it's just a long time ago.
Is there anything else you'd like to say or remember?
Let me just put this on the table. I'm not sure how important it is, but because I was serving on the board in virtue of my editorship, I think that, because I was not, I don't think I was elected to the board a second time, but I know I was serving on the board when Jerry Hauser invented the retreat, and when David Zareski was president the first time. That's when I saw how a meeting ought to be run. David Zareski knows how to run a meeting. He knows how to get things done. He knows how not to waste time. He knows how to have an agenda and follow it through, and yet to let people have their say, to hear points of view. I was just terrifically impressed by the leadership, particularly of David and Jerry, and then of Jerry Hauser. And I think, in part, that comes from communication department training. One of the things I learned to be envious of in my comm department colleagues is most of them had some kind of forensics training. I had zero experience of extemporaneous public speaking, of debate, again, running a meeting as something that one can learn how to do. And in English departments, we don't do that. We don't do it well. And so our models are bad. so the different kinds of training that academics receive in their undergraduate and graduate degrees, I think makes a difference. So I learned to respect that.
Thanks so much for your time. That was really wonderful.
Well, I'm appalled at the holes in my memory here. And I can go look up the details if anyone really wants to know. But that's not what oral histories are about, I guess.
Thanks, Carolyn.
Sure.